Hello, everyone. I'm Drew.
I'm Bailey.
I'm Lacey.
And we're sarcastic, so let's get sinister.
Everybody.
This is going to be a
Hi.
fun recording because, correct me if I'm wrong, but two-thirds of us are sick. Lacey,
And I'm
you are the healthy
okay.
one.
I am.
Good. I
Should
have
we
some.
compare symptoms?
Well, I think that I'm coming out of it. Like, I think I was in the last 24 hours were real rough for me, but I'm starting to feel better, so I think I'm on my way out.
Good.
But I do have some tea.
I'm blaming my symptoms on an antibiotic.
Oh, interesting. So do you have I have a cold. I know that for sure. I have fever,
Oh. The
sore
last few days
throat.
I've been having wicked stomach aches.
Wicked. Well, that's so there is a stomach bug going around.
I mean, I haven't vomited or anything, but the nausea and pain is there. But I'm
Well, that's
on
good.
antibiotics for a sty on my eye that's been attached to me for 3 weeks.
Yes, I remember that. My daughter asked you about it.
I was there for that. I
Yeah.
was a monster.
She still talks about it. It's No, she doesn't. Before we get started, so I got a lot to tell you with my case. But before we, so I want to jump in, but before we get started, I wanted to tell you about some true crime news that happened earlier this week. So, do you guys remember the lady who attacked random people in a 7-Eleven in Australia with an axe?
Vaguely.
No.
I
Okay,
think I
so
do.
I'll remind you. In January 2017, so 8 years ago, Evie Amati,
That's weird.
huh?
I was like, oh, that math is wrong. And then I did the math and I was like, oh, fuck. 2017 was 8 years ago.
You're an English teacher, not a math.
I feel weird about 2017 being 8 years ago.
So she entered a 7-Eleven near her home at 2 a.m. She w just walked in with an axe, as you do. She approached the man at the counter, whose name was Ben Rimmer. He was just there buying a meat pie. She said like a couple words to him and then just swung the axe at his face.
No. She just walked in casually with an axe. No one reacted before she started swinging.
Well, it was 2 a.m., so literally, there's a security video. She walked in, she stood next to him. They like said a couple words to each other, and then she just attacked him. If I was in the store and I saw somebody with an axe, I'd be like, that's not supposed to be here. But nobody questioned why. Maybe it's Australia. I
Okay,
don't
they
know.
gotta defend from all the poisonous snakes and the bugs.
Yes, exactly.
I do think if I was in a store, like you said, and I saw somebody coming in with an axe, I would be keeping an eye on them at all times while maybe getting closer to the door
I
as
would
I walked
definitely
between
keep an
there
eye
and the
on the
door.
axe.
I wouldn't want them between me and the door.
Right. She wasn't. I'm not gonna victim blame. But anyway,
No.
so Ben collapsed to the ground. So she stepped over him and swung the axe at her second victim, who was a woman who just purchased a get like some milk. And she was actually like walking through the doorway, leaving when she hit her with the axe. She hit Sharon Hacker in the back of the head. And so now she is out of the 7-Eleven. So she approaches her third victim, who he was at the gas pumps, but he used his backpack as a shield to defend against the swing. So he was uninjured. Ben Rimmer got a 4-inch facial wound and several facial fractures. Sharon Hacker's skull was fractured. Both were extremely lucky. If the axe had hit Ben a millimeter higher, it would have been life-threatening. And Sharon's dreadlocks cushioned the blow to her head, so she was, didn't die.
Jesus, that's lucky.
Yeah. Evie pleaded not guilty to two counts of wounding with intent to murder and one count of attempted wounding. Pardon? What?
You said she's pleading not guilty?
She pled not guilty. Yeah. Do you know why?
But you said that there was, like, video of it.
Yes, but Bailey, she wasn't in her right mind. She had a mental illness and was under the influence of hormone medication, cannabis, amphetamines, and alcohol.
Well, you know that cannabis makes people go crazy with axes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry. I'm stumbling over the amphetamines and alcohol.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay. What a mix.
She was also, she had just broken up with her girlfriend. And she just had, like, a bad Tinder date. So she had a lot going on. Okay?
Yeah.
Okay. How'd that plead work out for her?
Well, she was sentenced to 9 years in prison. But was released earlier this week after 8 years.
Okay.
So she's back out on the street. That's the news. She's out and about now.
If she thought she had a bad Tinder date, what was that, 8 years ago? She's not going to be happy with the pickings now.
No. She's got a lot going on. So she, in 2016, had done... she had a sex change operation. She had gone from being Carl to Evie. And so that was the hormone medication that was influencing her behavior. She was women's hormones, right? They make everybody crazy.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, estrogen's a hell of a drug.
Yeah. I can't tell you how many times I've attacked people with axes. but since being released, she said that she's going to be transitioning back to being a man. Because hormones, probably.
She can't risk being a woman any longer. It was not good for her.
I mean, she went to women's prison, probably, and was like, oh, these are annoying.
Like, oh my god, the amount of hormones in this place alone. Yeah. Women, the worst.
But is she going to go back to being called Carl now?
I don't know.
Or you think she's going to change her name?
I feel like going from Carl to Evie is like a
upgrade.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah.
And so it would feel weird to kind of go back to Carl, in my opinion. I feel like to like another cool name would be good. Yeah. No offense to all the Carls out there.
This is the time for a fresh start. You know,
yes.
But you're out of jail.
She does. She got some tattoos while in prison, and I don't know what's going on in Australia, but they do good work. Like, she's got like a whole arm sleeve now, and it's like a zombie eating a can of soup that says brains on it, or brain soup.
Ooh.
And then she's also got DEAD on her knuckles.
Dead.
It took Bailey a minute. So I'm glad that she's in Australia.
I don't know how anyone else feels, but did you guys watch The Walking Dead?
The beginning.
I watched the first several seasons, but I never finished.
I think Lacey and I watched together the first several seasons, and then
after a while we fell off.
Probably when we stopped living together, we both just decided to stop keeping up.
It got harder.
Anyway.
Life got harder.
It's ruined the name Carl for me. So
it's very cringe. Well, that is the first thing I think I want to hear, Carl.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So this might change. Carl from Walking Dead is with a C.
Mm-hmm.
This Carl's name started with a K.
Oh, like Carl Marx.
That's what I think of. I think of Carl Marx.
That's fun. No real.
All I hear is Rick from The Walking Dead screaming Carl.
Carl.
Also, Lacey, you sound quieter today.
Should I lean in?
Are you close to your
microphone? My microphone doesn't have like a volume thing, so I'm just
I think you sound great.
Here, thanks. I'll be in a little bit. Hold
All right, are we ready to get to the meat and potatoes?
Yes.
Okay. So, who knows, who's heard
Of the
about,
Muffin Man?
no, close, the
The
Murdaws?
Ooh. Ooh.
Lacey?
I watched there was a documentary
Oh, yeah.
yes. On Netflix or I think Netflix. Yeah. Ooh, this
Did
is
you
fun. This is a fun one.
watch
I
the
did watch
documentary?
it.
Oh no, you know so much.
I know. This is the first time in a while that I know stuff.
Shoot. All
I don't
right.
know anything.
Perfect. Well, then strap in, Bailey, because we're gonna talk about the rise and fall of the Murdaws.
I don't have a strap.
Well, just hold on tight.
Okay.
So, the Murdaugh family was a prominent family from South Carolina going back generations. Joseph W. Davis was the cousin of Confederate President Jefferson Davis. Joseph was the father of Annie Marvin Davis. Annie married Josiah Putnam Murdaugh II, who was a wealthy businessman.
Josiah.
Yeah, he's the one at the top.
Wow.
Bailey's looking at a family tree that I have up on the screen. Their youngest son was named Randolph Murdaugh Sr., and he was born in 1887. At the time of his birth, he was not named senior, but he accumulated that.
As one
Imagine naming
does.
your kid something senior just in preparation.
Yeah,
You're kind of locking them in. So I'm just going to warn you, they recycle names like crazy within this family. So just, that's why I have the family tree, because it can be confusing. Randolph Sr. graduated from USC, which is the University of South Carolina, law school in 1910. He founded a law firm in Hampton, which is 78 miles west of Charleston. He also ran a daily newspaper called the Hampton County Herald. But that's his parents. Don't they look cute?
He's a very stern face.
Well, he's got a lot going on.
Wait, no, his
And
head is
also,
only held on by that collar.
yeah, it doesn't look like he has a neck.
In 1914, Randolph Sr. married Etta Causey Harvey. Etta was the daughter of a successful doctor and the sister of State Senator W. Brantley Harvey Sr. So, like, from both sides, they're just like lots of importance, you know? Money, old money. Etta and Randolph had two sons, Randolph Jr., whom they nicknamed Buster for some reason, and John Glenn, who they called Johnny. In 1920, Randolph became the solicitor in the 14th Judicial Circuit. The solicitor is the elected prosecuting attorney for the circuit, so he was the prosecuting attorney. He held that position for 20 years before he died in a traffic collision when his car was hit by a freight train. The cause of the crash has been speculated as being an act of suicide or possibly alcohol related. So now we're moving down to Randolph Jr. But before we do, I just want to throw in there, John Glenn joined the army and served in World War II. He became highly decorated, receiving a Silver Star, two Bronze Stars, and two Purple Hearts. After the war, he left the army and became a farmer, which I thought was nice.
It's fun.
Meanwhile, his older brother, Randolph Jr., aka Buster, followed in his father's footsteps. He too earned a law degree from USC in 1938. After his father's death, he held the position of circuit solicitor for 46 years. He sued the train company and they settled for an undisclosed amount. Buster was known for his antics in the courtroom. He acted out murders and was actually criticized by the state Supreme Court several times. They warned him about improper closing arguments, including arguing in a rape case that if the defendant was acquitted, he'd released other accused rapists. Which feels like a little bit of a tantrum. Like, he was like, if you guys don't sentence him to jail, I'm just gonna let all the rapists out, because, like, why not?
There's a little dramatic.
There's a little part in Family Guy where they're, like, shopping for a stuffed animal or whatever, and Brian reads the tag and is like, oh, every, like, purchase saves a giraffe or something in the wild. But if you don't purchase it, we kill a giraffe in the wild. It feels kind of like that.
Yeah.
Yes. In 1956, a federal grand jury indicted Buster for allegedly warning a bootlegger to move his moonshine still. He was acquitted and retired in 86 before dying in 98. Buster had married Gladys Marvin, and together they had a son, Randolph Murdaugh III, in 1939. Randolph III, I know this is going to surprise you guys, graduated from USC with a degree in business administration and law in the early 60s. Like his father before him, he took over as circuit solicitor following his father's retirement. He held the position
Does anyone else in the fucking state want to be circuit solicitor? Jesus Christ.
No, they've got it under control.
Briefly, after Buster was indicted for telling the moonshiners to move, he stepped down, mm-hmm. and somebody else held the title for like a year. But then once he was acquitted, he like took it back. So yes, other people want it. I think it's an elected position.
And the fact that he had to step down for a year for telling someone to move their shit didn't turn people off from voting for him?
Apparently not.
Okay.
I mean,
don't.
What?
Nope. Move on.
I don't know if you know what I'm going to talk about.
I could see the road we're going down.
Okay. So, Randolph the Third now, he's in that picture, the second oldest one. He held the position for 20 years before retiring and returning to private practice at his family's law firm. Randolph III married Elizabeth, a.k.a. Libby Alexander, and they had four children. Randolph IV, whom they called Randy, Richard Alexander, who they called Alex, John Marvin, and Lynn Murdaugh. Of Randolph the Third's children, only Randy and Alex went into the family business of law. But we're going to focus on Alex's branch of the family tree. So, Richard Alexander Murdaugh. Oh, that's Murdaugh the Third. There's Alex.
Alex doesn't look good. At least in that photo.
I feel like he kind of looks like Conan with makeup, like he was trying to do Undercover Boss.
Like Conan Scrooge crossover.
Yes. Definitely yes. Thickly Conan. Conan Scrooge is a good...
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he was born May 27th, 1968. He usually goes by, even though his first name is Richard, he goes by Alex or Alec. He graduated from USC Law in 1994. He joined the family firm called Peters, Murdaugh, Parker, Eltzroth, and Detrick Law Firm. Which, is that like, why do they have to put all of the names?
I was going
to
say, there should be a limit on how many names. Like, I know it's all the partners, but like, you shouldn't be allowed to have that many if it's going to make your name so clunky.
Mm-hmm. They go by like PMPED.
That's okay.
Yeah. I mean, it's better than having it Murdaugh, Murdaugh, Murdaugh.
Just all Murdaughs.
Yeah.
While at school, Alex met Margaret, a.k.a. Maggie, Kennedy Branstetter. Maggie was born September 15th, 1968, in Nashville, Tennessee, to Terry and Kennedy Brandstetter. So even her family recycles the names. Her parents were high school sweethearts. Not sweethearts. Sweethearts
We
in
talked.
Kentucky, but they married in Tennessee because they were too young to do so in Kentucky. Like the
It's kind
legal
of
age was.
romantic.
Yeah. Terry began working for DuPont after college. Maggie's older sister, Marion, was born in June 1963. Terry's work caused his family to move first to Wilmington, North Carolina, then to Unionville, PA, where they lived for 7 years in the 80s. After PA, Terry was transferred to Cooper River, South Carolina. This is where Maggie attended college. She went to USC, becoming a sister of the Kappa Delta sorority. Bailey put on a hat. Just
I
noticed.
my hair was looking not good.
Okay.
Go birds.
And she graduated in 1991. Alex was a year ahead of her at school, and they married in August 1993. In 1996, which was when Bailey was born, Maggie gave birth to their first son, Richard Alexander Jr., who they called Buster. So they're even recycling the nicknames.
They're not a
Where?
very creative family.
It's all about tradition, they say.
Their second son, Paul Terry, was born April 14th, 1999. Buster earned a undergraduate degree from Wofford College in 2018 before attending law school at USC. Due to a low GPA, Buster was not readmitted following his first year at law school. As a result, Alex paid a lawyer $60,000 to persuade the dean to readmit Buster. By most accounts, I don't actually know what happened with that, just so you know. By most accounts, Buster was much more easygoing and well-adjusted than Paul. Paul's friends described him as becoming a different, destructive person when he drank, having an alter ego named Timmy.
I have a drunk alter ego too.
Is it named Timmy?
No, her name's Bianca.
Well,
Bianca.
Timmy gets at Paul into trouble, so hopefully Bianca behaves
I
herself.
mean, she just wants to drink more.
Okay. We'll get to the kind of trouble Timmy gets in, but it sounds like Bianca's okay.
She's the life of the party.
Maggie and Alex split their time between their beach house in Edisto, which is the picture on the top, and their hunting lodge in Islington, which is the picture on the bottom. Sources said that at the time of the events that we're going to be talking about, Maggie and Alex had been growing apart, living separate lives. She spent most of her time at the beach house, while Alex stayed at the hunting lodge, which they called Moselle. It was located on Moselle Street, so they all just called it Moselle. Some sources claimed that Maggie was visiting a divorce attorney in April 2021, but a friend of hers said that that's not true and it's nobody's business.
That seems like it is true.
State Senator Dick Harpootlian, who is Alec one of Alex's two lawyers, vehemently disputed reports that the Murdaugh marriage was on the rocks. He saw the two together on a regular basis, holding hands on occasion. Dick saw the couple regularly because all three men in this branch of the family tree dealt with a series of legal issues. Yes, Bailey.
You said this was one of his lawyers?
Yes, he has two.
Okay. Is one a divorce attorney and the other one's like criminal?
No, they're both just his lawyers because all three men in this branch of the family tree dealt with a series of legal issues. Maggie, however, was only guilty of one thing, according to friends and family, spoiling her sons. Maggie lived for her kids. She was described as being the most down-to-earth Murdaugh. When their housekeeper, Gloria Satterfield, was dying in the hospital, Maggie was the only one of the four of them to visit her. Gloria had fallen at the Murdaugh house and later died as a result. We'll talk more about that in a bit. So the legal issues really began in 20, well, that we kind of can really nail down, began in 2015 when Alex and Maggie were in their late 40s. Buster was 19 and Paul was 16. On July 8th, 2015, oh, this is a map of their hunting lodge or the Moselle property. The yellow is where that house was that I showed you a picture of. The green is the main gate, so you could w drive in and pull up. Then they had an equipment storage shed over here, some dog kennels over here, mailbox. Okay. So, on July 8th, 2015, Stephen Smith was found dead on Sandy Run Road in Hampton County. The case was initially ruled a hit and run, but during the investigation, the Murdaugh name was mentioned dozens of times by witnesses as possibly being involved. Rumors spread that Buster and Stephen had been in a relationship. Stephen was openly gay, but Buster denied all allegations. Buster claimed that at the time of Stephen's death, he had been at their family beach house with Maggie and his brother. Stephen was 19, with plans of one day becoming a doctor. He was a cheerful young man who liked to make others smile. His mother said that he was teased in school, but he held himself high because he was a born fighter. Stephen and his twin sister Stephanie were born at 27 weeks. Stephen weighed 2 pounds and 12 ounces, and he couldn't breathe on his own. After several months, he was finally strong enough to leave the hospital. His mother, Sandy, and family attorneys have raised the possibility Stephen was targeted because of his sexuality. The day before Stephen was killed, he'd called his sister for help with his car. The battery cable was loosened, so she tightened it. Also before his death, Stephen told his mom that he was going deep sea fishing with someone prominent, but he couldn't disclose who. Sandy says Stephen had become more secretive the last couple weeks of his life. Other people took issue with the hit-and-run theory. Retired South Carolina Highway Patrol Lieutenant Thomas Moore was the on-scene supervisor. At the scene, there was noticeably no vehicle debris, no broken headlights, and no paint scrapes. Also unusual for a hit-and-run, Stephen's clothing was intact and his shoes, which were loosely tied, were still on. Stephen's car keys and cell phone were in his front pocket, unharmed. Moore believed Stephen's body appeared staged. His body was laying like it had been placed in a certain position, not what you would typically see, and it looked like someone had hit him in the head with some kind of object. Interestingly, at first, the sheriff told Stephen's family that he'd been shot. But hours later, the medical examiner ruled it a hit and run. When Moore confronted the ME about this ruling, she said there was no bullet found, and basically because he was found in the road, hit and run. 3 miles away from Stephen's body, investigators found his car. The doors were locked, his wallet was inside, and the gas cap was hanging open. As the investigation continued, rumors began to swirl. The initial rumor was that Stephen was planning to go away with Buster Murdaugh and his family, that they were together romantically. Another rumor was that at least one Murdaugh child was in a vehicle with one or two more boys, and someone in the vehicle struck Stephen with a baseball bat. That rumor was that the truck was riding down the street, saw the car on the side of the road, maybe saw Stephen walking. They turned back around and stuck the baseball bat at the window and like hit him with that while they were driving. According to the case file, a call to Buster Murdaugh in October 2015 was never returned. Currently, the only connection between Stephen and Buster known by the public is that he and Buster were classmates in high school. By late 2016, the investigation into Stephen Smith's death went cold. Stephen was buried in his scrubs with a stethoscope in his pocket.
I like that. Excuse me. I like that all they did was call him, and when he didn't call back, they were like, well, I guess we can't talk to him about it.
I
He
think,
didn't pick up Lacey.
he's obviously busy.
I think instead of him calling back, his lawyer called them and was like, he wasn't involved. Don't bother him again. Don't worry, that comes back later. On February, so that was the first bit of legal trouble in 2015. On February 2nd, 2018, the Murdaugh's housekeeper, Gloria, suffered a severe head injury when she allegedly was tripped by one of their dogs and fell down the front steps of the family home. On February 26th, she died due to complications from the fall, i.e., a stroke. No coroner was notified and no autopsy was performed. The death certificate attributed the death to natural causes. Gloria's two sons were awarded $4.3 million from the insurance policy payout from the Murdaugh's home insurance. But it took years to receive the money because Alex Murdaugh, along with his banker, Chad Westendorf, and his attorney, Corey Fleming, diverted the payout to Alex's bank account. Gloria's sons eventually were able to recover $6.5 million after filing subsequent lawsuits, but that was like 5 years later. So they stole
They
his
just
money.
took the money.
Yeah.
Sure.
So then this is where we find out about more about Timmy. On February 24th, 2019, at around 2:17 a.m., 19-year-old Paul Murdaugh crashed his family boat into the Archer's Creek Bridge in South Carolina. On the boat at the time were several other teenagers, including Mallory Beach. She was killed in the accident, and Paul was charged with three felony counts of boating under the influence, as well as causing the death of Mallory and seriously injuring two others. So, this becomes a big deal. As I'm sure you can imagine, because, someone died. And it was definitely Paul's fault. Mallory Madison Beach was born April 18th, 1999. She and her boyfriend Anthony were on the boat with Paul, his girlfriend, and three other couples. Paul had used his brother's ID to purchase alcohol from a convenience store hours before the accident. They boarded the boat to go to a house party and oyster roast. Which, have you guys ever been to an oyster roast?
I am not.
It sounds
No.
very posh.
Posh. The posh oyster roast.
Yeah. They left the party at around 7 p.m., and on the return trip at 1 a.m., they stopped at a dockside bar where Paul and. Oh, sorry. Paul and another passenger did shots. Paul began behaving erratically, and while other passengers asked him to allow someone else to drive the boat, he refused. He started driving in circles and acting drunk, so passengers asked him to let them out at a nearby dock. Paul refused. He reportedly kept leaving the wheel to fight with his girlfriend, which is good. I think you're supposed to do that. Boats drive on their own, right?
Sure, especially the smaller ones.
He allegedly shoved, spit on, and slapped his then girlfriend just prior to the crash. At about 2:20 a.m., the boat crashed into the bridge. Mallory was ejected from the boat into the dark water. Another passenger called 911 and begged for help. First responders immediately began searching for her. The other passengers were transported to a hospital, except for Mallory's boyfriend Anthony, who wanted to stay behind. One passenger was treated for a broken jaw, and another was treated for a badly injured hand. According to hospital staff, Paul was uncooperative, and several hours after the crash, his BAC was 0.24.
That's
Which
high.
I
Just a little high. Hospital staff also told investigators that they observed Paul's father, Alex Murdaugh, going from room to room attempting to speak with the other survivors. A security guard also reported that he overheard him on the phone saying, "She's gone, don't worry." So in this picture, it's a security picture from the hospital. Obviously, you can see Paul. He's the one in scrubs because I'm assuming his clothing was taken. You can see his dad in white, and then that's his dad's older brother, the lawyer, Randy. Investigators and volunteers using rescue boats, divers, and a helicopter spent 8 days searching for Mallory Beach. On March 3rd, 2019, two volunteers found Mallory's body about 5 miles down the river from the crash scene. A month after the boat crash, Mallory's family filed a wrongful death suit against members of the Murdaugh family. On April 18th, 2019, on what would have been Mallory's 20th birthday, Paul Murdaugh was indicted and charged. Paul pleaded not guilty to all the charges, but he would never have his day in court. All right. So that brings us to June 7th. That's Bailey's birthday. 2021. Bailey is not into it. Rolling her eyes. Alex called Maggie and asked her to meet with him at the hunting lodge so that they could travel together to visit Alex's terminally ill father, Randolph III. Maggie offered to just meet him at the hospital, but Alex insisted they meet at the lodge to drive together. Maggie texted a friend saying her husband sounded fishy and was up to something. Maggie arrived at the lodge, which was located on a 1,772-acre estate. What do you do with all that? Like, why do you need that many acres? Lacey, are you
Gardening.
talking?
She's muted. Jesus Christ, Lacey.
Muted myself because I was coughing. I said that you stand out there and you just look around and you're like, these are my acres.
Okay.
Usually with a mug of coffee on your porch.
Nobody's around because
But
all of these acres are
you
mine.
also go.
It's breathing in the air.
Yeah.
Maggie left her car running, got out, and walked towards the dog kennels, where she ran into 22-year-old Paul.
What
The
kind of
kennels,
dogs did they have?
hunting dogs.
For the acres.
Yeah, they weren't treated like house dogs.
No, I got that because they lived outside and that's
Yeah.
fine. They're working dogs. But, like, what breeds?
I don't know.
Froggy details.
I don't know what breeds.
Your
I
lack
know
of information and detail d disappoints me.
that, well, sorry.
Well.
I can tell you the breed of one dog, but we're not there yet. The kennels were built like a kind of lean-to with 8 stalls and a feed room. At 10:06 p.m., Alex called the police to report that he'd discovered the bodies of his wife and son, shot multiple times. When investigators first arrived at the scene, Maggie and Paul Murdaugh were found dead at the dog kennels on the property with gunshot wounds to their heads. Sergeant Daniel Green was first on scene. As Green approached Murdaugh, he told Green that he had a loaded gun at the scene, but it was leaning against his vehicle, not on his person. The shotgun was a Benelli Super Black Eagle, and he claimed he got the gun for protection from killers after discovering the bodies. When Green confirmed he'd gotten the gun from inside the house, Murdaugh began telling him that his son had been receiving threats due to the death of Mallory Beach. So, like, Green was like, "You got the gun from inside?" And Murdaugh responded, "Yes, sir. I went and got. This is a long story. My son was in a boat wreck months back. He's been getting threats. Most of it's been benign stuff we didn't take serious. He's been getting punched. I know that's what it is." Which Green thought was weird because, like, I didn't ask you about that.
Yeah, felt a little rambly.
Green noted that Murdaugh was not crying. But seemed nervous and upset. He also noted Murdaugh did not have any blood on him. More responders arrived at the scene. Both Maggie and Paul were confirmed dead. Around Paul's body, there was a large amount of blood, but also a large pool of water. It had rained earlier that night, but not nearly enough to cause the amount of water pooled around Paul. Paul was found outside the feed room, which in that picture is the doorway to the feed room, right there, and he's blurred on the ground. He was face down with his hands underneath him, feet toward the building. He was saturated in blood, with the majority of his head gone and most of his brain lying on the ground.
Oh, thank you.
His phone was found on top of his shorts, outside of his pocket, like on his butt. Which is an interesting position. In case you guys didn't think that was interesting, I'll tell you. It's an interesting position.
Well, someone probably used it, then tossed it on him.
Maggie was found face down with a large amount of blood around her as well. She had multiple gunshot wounds. Shell casings identified as belonging to a 300... Okay, so then here's another picture of Paul. And there's like a diagram of where they were in relation to each other. And that's where they found Maggie. A little blood right there. Okay. Shell casings identified as belonging to a 300 blackout were found on the ground. A dead chicken was found on top of some dog crates in the kennels. Murdaugh told deputies that he had gone for about an hour and a half visiting his mom and hadn't seen Maggie and Paul for about 45 minutes before that. After a while, Murdaugh called his brother Randy, who showed up at the scene sometime later and was allowed to interact with Alex. Other questionable things that occurred include the fact that law enforcement walked all over the scene. They took care not to disturb anything, but they weren't wearing any protective items. Several of them noticed tire marks in the nearby grass, but no one did anything to protect the integrity of those marks. Right. Also, sheets were placed over the bodies before crime scene investigators arrived on scene. And I know this from my experience as an EMT. Typically, the people in charge of like doing autopsies and stuff, collecting evidence, prefer that not happen. Because it can contaminate the body, it can mess with evidence.
Makes sense.
But they, law enforcement said that they did this to protect the family's feelings.
That feels like a weird reason.
Well, I mean,
what feelings and whose?
Well, Alex was at the scene, Randy showed up, and Paul's brain was outside of his head.
Yeah.
Okay, but they didn't have to stand right next to him.
Yeah, that's right. Also.
And I'm assuming, you know,
there's also like 1,700 other acres that they could move to.
Right. Plus, he'd already seen them. Like he was the one who found them and called the cops. So, just direct him away from the bodies.
Yeah. I mean, I'm with you guys. They shouldn't have done that, but that's what they said.
Tell him not to look.
Turn your back.
He's not a 5-year-old that's just gonna fixate on it. Just look another direction.
So as they began investigating, a gunshot residue kit was completed on Alex. The standing water outside the kennels that had caused Paul's clothing to be wet underneath, they noticed that there was no water hose present. So they don't know at that time, they didn't know where the water came from. Maggie's phone was missing. But they did find it with the help of the Find My iPhone feature, and it was located the next day along a road not far from the Moselle property. Oopsie. Blood droplets were analyzed at the scene. Inside the feed room, investigators determined that the blood on the floor, being pretty much completely circular, was dripping straight down from a wound. The investigators theorized that Paul sustained the first gunshot wound inside the feed room while he was facing away from the doorway. He slowly exited the room, leaving the blood droplets. And as he passed through the doorway, he was fatally shot and collapsed immediately, right outside the doorway. Several firearms were... So here's some more blood. There's a bullet hole in the window. Several firearms were seized from the gun room of the lodge. Just outside the room, weathered cartridges were found on the ground, and it had appeared that they had been there for a while. Colleton County Coroner Richard Harvey placed the time of death between 9 and 9:30. Dr. Ellen Reamer performed both autopsies on June 10th. She determined that two weapons were used. Among the weapons seized from the gun room were a 12-gauge shotgun and an AR-style rifle. It was determined that these were the same models as the weapons used to murder Maggie and Paul. So, let's go over autopsies.
Let's.
Thank you, Lacey. Paul Murdaugh sustained injuries from a shotgun. He was shot first in the left side of his chest. The wound was oblong, indicating the bullet entered his chest at an angle. So Paul was not facing the shooter. The bullet exited his torso under his left arm before traveling through his arm and out the window in the room. This first bullet did not enter his chest cavity, but just traveled through the soft tissue of his torso before exiting. This wound caused a contusion on his left lung, but the doctor was confident that this wound was not immediately fatal. A second shot entered through, she said it grazed his left shoulder, and then entered in his neck jaw area before exiting through the right side of his head. The bullet traveled at a somewhat front-to-back angle. As a result, his brain was ejected from his skull and arrived at the autopsy in a separate bucket.
Don't like it.
Paul's face was completely intact, but had a scrape on the left side. Dr. Reamer believed that the scrape was caused by a sudden collapse from Paul's face hitting the ground. Because Paul's face was left intact, the angle of the bullet's path, the doctor later testified in court that Paul's face was turned towards his left in the direction of the shooter, and this shot was immediately fatal for obvious reasons. So evidence of stippling was found around Paul's wounds, and for those who don't know, stippling is the burning of either clothing or skin by the gunpowder, which fires out of the gun along with the bullet. This indicates that the gun was fired at a close range, usually within 3 feet. Paul's toxicology report revealed the only substance in his blood was caffeine at the time of his death. Maggie Murdaugh sustained 5 gunshot wounds from an assault rifle. The first gunshot entered close... Yes.
Why is the illustration so curvy?
Because she's a lady.
A lady.
Did you not notice that when you, like, found the photo? Like, she's got hips for days. She's thick.
Lady okay. Hips.
I'm just saying. She's like, why is it so apparent that she's got such hips?
I don't know.
It's a weird choice.
Okay. I didn't choose it. Dr. Reamer did.
I'm saying it's weird for her.
Okay. So, 5 gunshot wounds from an assault rifle. The first gunshot entered close to her midline, but to her right, just below her rib cage on the interior aspect. So, this one right here. The bullet traveled about 10 inches to a left downward angle, exiting through the left side of her lower back. So, in the autopsy photos, or not autopsy, in her drawings, she marked an entrance wound with blue and the exit wound with red. After entering the abdomen, the bullet damaged her pancreas, her left kidney, her left iliac artery, as well as other minor vessels and her intestines. So the second gunshot was to her left thigh. Like the first, this bullet also traveled front to back, to the left, and downward. This bullet damaged the muscle and tissue, but not the bone, before it exited through the back of her thigh. Both these wounds had stippling from gunpowder, indicating the shooter was within 3 feet of Maggie. A third bullet entered through the posterior aspect of Maggie's wrist and exited through the anterior part of her forearm. These 3 wounds were not immediately fatal. So, entered the wrist and kind of went upward. Yeah. The 4th and 5th wounds were immediately fatal. A fourth bullet entered on the underside of her left breast, traveled in an upward trajectory through her breast, leaving bruising on her left clavicle, before entering through the underside of her head, near her left ear. An abrasion was located on the left side of Maggie's abdomen, indicating that this fourth bullet had scraped her abdomen prior to penetrating her body. It was noted that this wound and the wound to her wrist did not have stippling. So those two were shot further away. A fifth gunshot wound was found at the base of Maggie's skull. This bullet traveled downward before fragmenting and causing multiple exit wounds to the right shoulder. This wound damaged her brainstem and her cerebellum. Dr. Remar believed that Maggie sustained the first two gunshots while standing upright, facing the shooter. After those injuries were inflicted on her, she bent over, like in pain, and Dr. Remar theorized that she was either bending over at the waist or even possibly on the ground on her hands and knees. This is when she sustained the fourth wound. This wound became immediately fatal and would have caused Maggie to fully collapse onto the ground. While lying on the ground, the shooter fired the final shot into the back of her head, ensuring that Maggie was dead. Dr. Remar did say that she could not be sure how many bullets hit Maggie. It could have been four or five. The doctor theorized that Maggie could have been clutching at her abdomen after being shot the two times, and the third shot traveled through her wrist before it entered her breast and then head. So, you know what I mean? Like, the fourth wound was actually the third. What I think happened was Maggie was shot and she fell on the ground and she was in her hands and knees position, and then the shooter shot her again. And, like, when she's like that, and the person is still in front of her, it would come in through the front or the posterior and come out the anterior aspect of the. Investigators searched, but were unable to locate the murder weapons. What they did find was that the cartridges found outside the gunroom showed matching mechanism marks when compared to the S&B 300 blackout cartridges found near Maggie's body. The mechanism marks that matched included firing pin marks, ejector marks, extractor marks, and chamber marks. Firearms examiner Paul Greer later testified at trial that, in his opinion, these cartridges were loaded into and ejected from the same firearm at some point in time. On April 14th, so we're going to kind of go back a little bit. On April 14th, 2018, the firearm in question, a black stripped-down AR rifle, was purchased for $875 by Maggie. She purchased the gun for Paul as a replacement weapon. Prior to that purchase, Maggie had purchased three other AR-style sporting rifles for both her sons as Christmas presents in December of 2016. However, Paul had misplaced his weapon, as you do.
As you do.
So Maggie got him a replacement in April 2018. But according to Alex, the replacement was stolen from Paul's truck during a party. Alex told officials that Paul was reckless, irresponsible, and always leaving his guns lying around at random places. However, Paul's friend, Will Loving, told law enforcement that in early 2021, he and Paul went to Ace Hardware because the stripped-down replacement gun had no optics or scope. He said in March or April of 2021, Paul purchased a red dot sight for that gun. And he had a receipt dated March 6th from Ace Hardware that was later used at trial. So, if it had been stolen, why was Paul purchasing parts for it?
Yeah, for the next one.
Right. Additionally, the shotgun shells found near Paul's body were the same brand, model, and size as the shells found in the house and workshop on the property. Data from the Murdaugh's phones was examined, and potential witnesses were interviewed. Investigators were able to piece together a timeline of the day's events. So, here we go. On the day of the murders, at 3:41 p.m., Alex attempted to FaceTime Maggie, but the call went unanswered. Interestingly, the record of the call was later manually deleted from Alex's phone. This becomes a running theme. An employee of the Murdaughs, Roger Dale Davis, arrived around then, before 4 p.m. He was there to feed the chickens, the dogs, and clean the kennels. He was alone at the property, and he left around 4:30. At 3:55, Maggie was at a doctor's appointment when she texted her current housekeeper, Blanca, that Alex was wanting her to come home. At 4:35, Alex at again attempted to FaceTime Maggie, but the call again went unanswered. Again, the record of the call was manually deleted from Alex's phone. GPS showed that Alex had spent the afternoon at his law firm, leaving at 6:24 p.m. At 6:40, Paul called his dad. This call lasted about 2.5 minutes, and the record of the call was found on Paul's phone alone, not Alex's. At 6:42, Paul's or Alex's phone placed him as arriving at Moselle. A minute later, he called Maggie. This call lasted almost 2 minutes, and the only record of it was on Maggie's phone, not Alex's.
Was Alex's phone working? Like, it seems so weird. He's
Well,
like leaving
yeah,
all this stuff.
it was working in that it was making and receiving phone calls, but it wasn't like maintaining that data. Well, no, it did maintain some data because some phone calls were recorded. And like it's weird because it would also like track his like fitness, so it was like he did 700 steps this minute or this hour, but it wasn't maintaining phone records to specific people.
Sounds like such a crazy
How
glitch.
bizarre.
At 7:04, Paul arrived at Moselle. From 7:07 to 7:50, Maggie was traveling to Moselle. While on the way, she made several calls to her friends and family, including her mom and her sister. At 7:56, Paul recorded a Snapchat video of his father standing by a tree on the Moselle property near the kennels. From 8:09 to 9:02, Alex's phone showed no movement, recorded no steps, and had no activity. He later told investigators that he'd been sleeping during this time. At 8:14, Paul's phone put him at the main house, but at 8:38, he was back at the kennels. At 8:40, Paul called his friend Rogan Gibson. This call lasted 4 minutes. Paul had been looking after Gibson's chocolate lab puppy named Cash. At the time, Gibson was staying with his girlfriend to be closer to his work. She was renting and was not permitted to have animals in the home, so Gibson was like storing his dog at the Murdaugh's kennel. According to Gibson, Paul had called to ask if something was wrong with Cash's tail. Gibson said that he didn't think so, but asked for a picture or to FaceTime to see. In the background, Gibson could hear Maggie and a male's voice, who he believed was Alex. Paul said he didn't know if he had enough service to do a FaceTime, so he offered to send a video. They did attempt to do a FaceTime, but it didn't work, so Paul recorded a video. At 8:49 p.m., Paul's phone locked, and it was never unlocked again. And just to like kind of reiterate how strange that is, I left out a bunch of messages and Snapchat stuff that Paul had been he'd been communicating with his friends for like the entire afternoon, almost constantly. Like he was a 19-year-old kid who was just like messaging people constantly. But then at 8:49, he stopped. At 8:49 p.m. that same time, Maggie read a text message in a group chat about Alex's dad. A few seconds later, her phone locked and it was not unlocked again by Maggie. At the same time, Rogan Gibson sent Paul a text message saying, quote, "See if you can get a good picture of it. Marion, his girlfriend, wants to send it to a girl we know that's a vet. Get him to sit and stay. He shouldn't move around too much." The text went unread. Gibson never received the video. He did try and call Paul a few times and he texted him but got no response. He contacted Maggie, but again, no response. A video was found on Paul's phone showing images of Gibson's puppy and three voices in the background. At 8:53, Maggie's phone screen was woken activating the Face ID security feature, but the phone was not unlocked. This indicated to investigators that someone picked up her phone, but did not have her face. So it was somebody else. At 9:04, Alex called Maggie's phone, then he called his father. Both records of these calls were not found on Alex's phone. At 9:06, Maggie's phone was woken again, but not unlocked. At the same time, Alex called her again. The record was not found on his phone. At 9:07, Alex left the property. At 9:08, GPS data from the phones and Alex's vehicle showed that he'd driven past the spot where Maggie's phone would later be found. Interestingly, after passing the location, the vehicle quickly increased speed. Alex texted Maggie at this time, saying, "Going to check on M, be right back." 2 minutes later, he called Buster. The call lasted 60 seconds, but there is no record of it in the data extraction from Alex's phone. At 9:22, Alex's vehicle arrived at his mom's house. At 9:46, Alex called Paul, again, with no record. Then he texted Maggie, "Call me, babe." At 10 o'clock, Alex returned to the main house at Moselle. At 10:05, he drove to the kennels. And at 10:06, he called 911. The call lasted 7 minutes. He hung up, telling the dispatcher that he needed to call family members. While on the phone with dispatch, however, he drove from the kennels to the main house. And then after he hung up, he drove back to the kennels. Law enforcement arrived at 10:25, and in those 10-ish minutes between him hanging up on dispatch and them arriving, Alex had called and texted his brothers, his sister-in-law, and those, you know, no records on his phone. The calls only lasted a few seconds, so they were likely unanswered. But then he called Rogan Gibson twice, but Gibson later said that he was already asleep, so he didn't answer either. Three days later, after the murders, on June 10th, 2021, Alex's father, Randolph III, died of cancer. At the end of June, Alex and Buster announced a $100,000 reward for information leading to the arrest and conviction of assailants involved in the murders of Maggie and Paul. Sorry, I had... Okay. Whoop, save that. I have videos that I wanted to show you of the video from the Snapchat, and then this one is, or that's the video from, that he sent to Rogan, and that's his 911 call. I'm going to save those for later. Okay. So then, okay, so after they announced the reward, things started kind of going wild, but like in a messy way. Especially for Alex. That summer, the South Carolina Law Enforcement Division, known as SLED, announced it would be opening an investigation into Stephen Smith's death based on information learned while investigating Maggie and Paul's murders. Around this time, Connor Cook, who was a passenger on the boat that Paul crashed, filed a lawsuit against Alex Murdaugh, the owner of the boat. In the lawsuit, Cook claimed that Murdaugh had tried to frame him as the driver of the boat. In September, Alex resigned from his law firm after his partners confronted him about suspected embezzlement.
Ooh.
It's said that at this time, Alex's world began to really crumble. Murdaugh has been implicated at this time in like 2025. Murdaugh has been implicated in nearly 100 other charges, including a plethora of financial crimes and drug trafficking. His MO, apparently, was to steal money from the people he represented. For example, he represented the family of Hakeem Pickney. Pickney was involved in a traffic accident in 2009 that left him requiring permanent life support. The family sued the manufacturer of the tire on the vehicle, and they won a settlement. Then, in 2011, Pickney's ventilator was mysteriously unplugged. A wrongful death lawsuit was filed against the care facility, and the family was awarded another settlement. They received some money, but around $800,000 to $1 million from both lawsuits, or both settlements, went missing. So his thing was, he like would offer to set up a bank account for these settlements to be put into, but he would have like the banker would put his name on the account, and then he would take all the money.
Interesting.
After Alex resigned that same month, he was changing a tire on a rural road when, according to him, a truck slowed down, shot him, and sped off.
Oh. How bizarre. Sorry.
Lacey is so bored.
So excited by his story.
The bullet grazed his head, resulting in a superficial injury. At the hospital, he tested positive for opioids and barbiturates.
He was trying to help the pain.
For the bullet hole? Or...
Yeah.
Okay. Soon after, Alex announced that he'd be going to rehab for substance abuse. About a week later, Alex's former client and cousin, Curtis Edward Smith, was arrested. Curtis had been Alex's source for oxycodone, and he conspired with Alex to kill him in the roadside shooting. Alex later admitted to law enforcement that he was super depressed and believed that if he had committed suicide, his son Buster wouldn't receive any insurance money. So he and Curtis concocted this murder scheme so Buster would receive the full $10 million from Alex's life insurance.
Curtis looks like a backwoods cousin.
Yeah, I heard somebody say that he was a distant cousin.
Yeah, I could see that. Also, what cousin agrees to murder you?
Well, so that's the thing. Curtis denied this, saying he never shot Alex, but shot into the sky to scare some sense into him.
The whole thing is goofy.
Murdahl was charged with insurance fraud, conspiracy to commit insurance fraud, along with filing a false police report. On September 16th, Smith was charged and bond was set at $55,000. 2 days later, Alex had his bond set at $20,000. After paying his bond, he returned to rehab. And this same month, authorities announced that they were going to be looking into Gloria Satterfield's death, the housekeeper. In October, Murdahl's former law firm filed a lawsuit alleging that he funneled stolen money from clients and the law firm into a fake bank account for years. After Murdahl was released from rehab, he was promptly arrested and charged with two felony counts of obtaining property by false pretenses. This was related to him misappropriating the settlement funds from the death of Gloria Satterfield. On December 13th, a judge set Murdahl's bond at $7 million for nearly 50 financial crime charges. In June 2022, law enforcement officials got permission to exhume the body of Gloria Satterfield. The same month, Alex was indicted on two counts related to a conspiracy to purchase and distribute narcotics using a money laundering scheme involving $2.4 million in stolen money with his cousin and accomplice Curtis Smith. On July 12, 2022, the South Carolina Supreme Court issued an official order disbarring Murdahl from the practice of law in South Carolina. He did not contest the decision.
No.
On July 14th, 2022, a little over a year after Maggie and Paul were murdered, Alex Murdahl was indicted on two counts of murder for the fatal shootings of Maggie and Paul Murdahl. He pleaded not guilty at the bond hearing, and Judge Clifton Newman denied his bond. The next month, Lindsay Edwards, a former sex worker, reported that at a private party, Murdahl began choking her, then raped her. She reported three more similar interactions with Murdahl. These accusations are still being investigated. So, on December 16th, 2022, Alex Murdahl was indicted by the state grand jury on nine counts of evading, near basically $500,000 in state income tax, so tax evasion. In January 2023, a judge approved a settlement between the family of Mallory Beach and the estate of Maggie Murdahl. Now, the double murder trial began on January 23rd, 2023, which is our mom's birthday, with Judge Clifton Newman presiding. Alex Murdahl was represented by his two lawyers, State Senator Dick Harpootlian and veteran criminal defense attorney Jim Griffin. Jury selection took a little while due to the notoriety of the accused, as well as the attention the murders had been receiving by the media. The trial lasted about 6 weeks, so I'm just going to go over some highlights. Prosecutor Creighton Waters told the jury that Paul entered the feed room at 8:49 p.m. when he was shot in the chest. Outside the feed room, Alex was crouching down to switch weapons when Paul began to exit the room. He started to turn towards his left to look at Alex, and Alex wasn't expecting him to come out, so he just, like, shot up at him. And that's why it was close range, and it was the upward trajectory. Maggie, hearing the gunfire, came to check on Paul. This is Alex used the assault rifle to shoot Maggie twice in the lower body. Maggie fell to the ground, and Alex shot her again. This bullet entered through her breast, traveled through to her head. The prosecution claimed financial issues and the boat crash were the motive behind the murders. When Mallory Beach's family filed a wrongful death suit against the Murdahls, Alex claimed he was broke. The lawyers requested a record of his finances, and fearing this would expose the financial crimes Alex had committed, he came up with his murder plot. Which, I mean, it doesn't seem like a great way to get out of murder, or to get out of trouble is to murder.
Murder your family.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It's like an overreaction, almost.
A little bit. I'm going to play. Somebody did a recreation. I'm going to show it to you. So, what are your thoughts on that recreation?
I like that it looked like they were ice skating.
Oh, okay.
I was thinking, I was like, oh, there, he's on a hoverboard.
Yeah. It makes sense for the,
So, the defense argued that the angles of the bullet holes found at the crime scene supported the idea that there were two short shooters. A forensic engineer who testified for the defense created a crime scene recognition image to show the jury a possible two-shooter scenario. He said that based on the trajectory of the bullets, the shooters must have been short, between 5'2 and 5'4. Because Alex Murdahl is 6'4, the defense argued he was too tall to have committed the murders.
There's little bitty murderers is what they're trying to sell us on. Between 5'2 and 5'4.
So to me, the Paul shooting makes sense. Oh, like, according to that reconstruction I showed you.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems strange to me that Maggie was shot first in the front at a close range. And then once she was down, the shooter went around to her back and shot her again. And then went around to her front to shoot her again.
Yeah.
It seems weird to move around that much.
You said after the first two, she was probably, like, on her hands and knees, right?
Mm-hmm.
I was going to say, what if after the first two, the shooter thought she was dead and was starting to walk away, and then she made noise, and they, like, turned around and shot her? But I guess she wouldn't have been, like, fully prone after those first two.
Well, so the doctor in court was very specific where she was like, there's no way that Maggie would have been fully on the ground after the first two shots,
okay,
because there had to have been some space for the bullet to go through her breast and into her head.
Okay.
But I was like, okay, well, maybe what if she was like trying to crawl away and she had turned her body away from the shooter And that's how we got the angle. But then there'd be like a blood trail. Unless she didn't go far at all. Murdoch's lawyer, Griffin, objected to the seized guns being entered into evidence, saying there is no evidence tying those guns at the house to Paul and Maggie's murders. He pointed out that firearms are mass manufactured and weapons manufactured at the same time in the same factory may have similar characteristics. This objection was overruled.
Cool.
The prosecution argued that Alex Murdaugh threw Maggie's phone out the window of his car in an attempt to dispose of evidence. Among the many witnesses who testified was Paul's friend Rogan Gibson. Rogan had known the family for around t 10 years at the time of the murders. And if you remember the final text that Paul received, Gibson had requested a photo of the dog. Instead, Paul took a video, and in the vi video played in court, three voices can be heard. Gibson identified with 100% certainty that they were the voices of Paul, Maggie, and Alex. Murdaugh can be heard talking to Maggie in the background about a dead chicken killed by a dog. His testimony contradicts his claim that he hadn't seen his wife and son for over an hour before their murders. So, if I play this, will you guys hear it?
We'll find out.
Okay. Actually, I want you to watch it too, because I feel like Bailey would enjoy seeing the puppy.
Get back. Quit, Cash. Come. Quit. That's okay. Come here. It's not that bad. Come here, Cash. Shit. Come here. Post it. Cash.
Hey, he's got a bird in his mouth.
Bubba. Hey, Bubba.
It's a guinea.
This is a chicken. Come here, Bubba.
Come here, Cash.
Come here, Bubba.
Cash. Quit.
So, Bailey, in your professional opinion, did you see anything wrong with Cash's tail?
No.
Okay, because neither did I.
But he's a
It
child.
feels to me so weak. Like, the fact that he contacted this guy about his dog and was like, I'm going to send you a video while he was like gearing up to kill his family feels
No,
like.
you're confused.
Oh, I am. Okay. Fix me.
Paul. That was Paul's friend, the son who was murdered.
Okay.
And in the
It wasn't the
background,
dad. You could hear
so.
Alex and
Yeah,
Maggie.
the theory is that Alex didn't know that Paul was recording.
That makes so much more sense. I was
Yeah.
super confused about that. I thought it was Alex the whole time, and I was like, why
No.
is he trying to build some weird alibi that he was like busy with this dog? I was so confused. Okay.
No. So the
They
theory is that
also
he didn't know that Paul was recording. What do you got, Bill?
it sounds like they one of the dogs attacked a chicken.
Yes, so remember how the police found a dead chicken on top of the one of the dog crates?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what Maggie and Alex were talking about in the background.
Well, because Maggie thought it was a
Guinea.
guinea fowl or
Yeah.
whatever.
And he said, that's a chicken.
And you can hear Alex saying Bubba a couple times.
I also Googled it. I know what kind of dogs they had.
Oh, okay, what are they?
They had a mix of labs and bird dogs, so I'm assuming pointers
Okay.
or like Brittany Spaniels.
I was gonna say labs, but I was like, oh, I don't know if that's true. But okay.
Now you know.
One of them was named Bubba.
We had two.
Roger Dale Davis Jr. worked for the Murdaughs and testified at the trial. He was the one who was there to feed the chickens and the dogs the night of the mur or the afternoon of the murders. He told the jury that almost every day for 4 years he cleaned the kennels at Moselle and carefully put away the hose. He testified he usually cleaned the kennels twice a day, every day, a routine that usually took him about 45 minutes. He was especially careful about how he treated the hose. Every day he would carefully unroll the hose, cut the water off to let it drain, and then carefully roll it back up so it wouldn't kink. According to Davis, both Murdaugh and Paul were not careful about how they put the hose away. And in the video shot by Paul, the hose can be seen on the ground with the water around it. Prosecutors suggested that Alex cleaned up the crime scene, then put the hose away. Because remember, when law enforcement arrived on the scene, the puddle was there, but the hose was not.
What was he trying to clean up, though?
Well, remember how he didn't have any blood on him? And I didn't find, they did a gunshot residue test on his hands, but I didn't find any notes about, or any results, so I assume that it came back negative.
Yeah, I think if it was positive, it would have been
noted.
Yeah.
Yeah. Alex took the stand to testify in his own defense. He admitted that it was his voice heard in the video. He said that he lied about his alibi because he was paranoid due to his drug addiction.
It's always a bold move when they take the stand for themselves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He admitted to stealing from his law firm, but he denied murdering his wife and son. In his version of events that night, he said that he and Paul had been driving around the property, checking on plantings for fields that they used to hunt doves. He said he was sweaty from work and that he was heavier back at that time, and the opioids that he had been addicted to made him sweat more. So he was super sweaty, so he took a shower after getting back to the house. And that was why, he said, he changed his into clean clothes and was reluctant to go back to the dog kennels. He was like, I don't want to get dirty again. He laid on the couch, he said, but then he opted to follow Maggie and Paul down to the dog kennels, taking a golf cart. The dogs were running around. One of them, Bubba, had chased and caught a chicken. Murdaugh said he took the chicken out of the dog's mouth and placed it on top of a dog crate at the kennel. He said then he drove the golf cart straight back to the house and laid down on the couch. So that's, presumably when he fell asleep. But, the timeline doesn't work out because he was there from 8 to 9 on the couch sleeping. And the video was shot at 8, 45.
That was tampered.
So, yeah. Shortly after leaving the kennels, he drove over to see his mother. He spent about 20 minutes there before returning to Moselle. When he later tried to call Maggie, he said he wasn't concerned when she didn't answer her phone. Data from Murdaugh's car showed he stopped at his mother's driveway for a period of time. In court, Murdaugh said that his phone had fallen between the seat and the console. Some theorized that he might have been using the time at his mother's to stash evidence nearby. His driving speed had also attracted notice. The vehicle reached speeds of up to 80 miles per hour on the rural roads, far above the posted speed limits. And when asked about that, Murdaugh said, I was driving how I normally drive.
Okay.
It's all the opioids he's on. He's
fast as fuck, boy.
Shelley Smith, the caregiver for Murdaugh's mother, was also called to testify. She said she saw Alex the night of the killings and that she saw him carrying what might have been a blue tarp into his mother's house in the days afterward. On the stand, Murdaugh said he couldn't recall bringing a tarp there, and he dismissed Shelley's statement, stating, Shelley's got something in her mind about that. I don't know what that means.
Why are we trusting his testimony over someone else's when he was, high during this?
And also, he's admitted to lying.
Mm.
That too.
So, what I find interesting is Shelley said that she saw him bringing a blue tarp, but a blue rain jacket, which you could argue is similar to a tarp, had been found in the closet at his mother's house. The jacket tested positive for gunpowder residue. Murdaugh said that he had nothing to do with it, but some speculated that it had been wrapped around a recently fired firearm. Murdahl said that he stayed at several places while they were investigating, so his clothes were just spread out all over the place. Another interesting thing was the 911 call made by Murdahl. It was played for the jury. And so apparently as soon as you dial 911, it starts recording before the dispatcher even picks up.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So you can hear like the ringing, but that's all you hear. And some people are like, that's interesting that he was quiet and seemingly calm. But as soon as the dispatcher answers, he starts like panting and sounding very like panicked. Like he just found some dead bodies. But before that, he was like chill. Also in the recording, Murdahl said he tried to check for a pulse and tried to turn Paul over. As he was moving him, Murdahl said in court, Paul's phone just popped out. And that's why it was on his butt and not in his pocket. Also in the recording, it seems Alex says, God dang it, Paul, why'd you get involved? It's unclear if that's what he said, because he was speaking while the dispatcher was speaking. But here's the recording, and you guys can listen and tell me what you think.
Oh, man, I've been gone. I just came back.
Okay, and was anyone else supposed to be at your house?
No, ma'am.
Hard to hear what he was saying. Yeah. I could tell he was talking.
It was... I can play it again. If you... It's... I think it's easier if you kind of in your head hear, like, read the subtitles as you're listening to it, where he says, God dang it, Paul, why'd you get involved? Okay?
Okay.
Oh, man, I've been gone. I just came back.
Okay, and was anyone else supposed to be at your house?
No, ma'am.
Like, I feel like you can hear, God dang it, Paul, and then involved. Very more clearly than anything else. But people thought that was weird. Like, what's he talking about? The prosecution told the jury that Alex killed his wife and son to gain sympathy and escape accountability for his string of financial crimes. The defense argued that there was no motive, and police had tunnel vision, blaming the husband and the person who had found the bodies was the easiest. On March 2nd, 2023, Alex Murdahl was found guilty of murdering Maggie and Paul Murdahl after the jury deliberated for almost 3 hours. Later, the jurors told reporters that the most significant piece of evidence that convinced them was the fact that Alex had lied. He only admitted to lying after the kennel video was found. And one juror said, if he didn't do it, how did he know what time to lie about not being there?
This is a smart jury.
Mm-hmm. The following day, on March 3rd, Alex Murdahl was sentenced to life in prison for each murder to be served consecutively without the possibility of parole. In an interview a few days after the sentencing, his older brother, Randy, said he believed that his brother had not told the whole truth about what he knew about the killings. A few days after the sentencing, Murdahl's attorneys filed an appeal. So, now we're going to kind of zoom out a little bit. We're almost done. Hang in there. On March 21st, 2023, SLED, which is the South Carolina Law Enforcement Division, announced it was now investigating Stephen Smith's death as a homicide, confirming that there was no indication that he had died in a hit and run. On March 31st, his body was exhumed so another autopsy could be performed. In April, Dr. Dupree oversaw the examination of Stephen's body. The second autopsy confirmed Stephen died from a single blow to his forehead, severely fracturing his skull. He had a 7.5-inch gash on his forehead. The doctor also confirmed he was not beaten with a bat. She described the injury as a linear fracture, not a pattern injury. They didn't find any other fractures, just to the head. They found a little road rash, which was expected, but no signs of a struggle and no signs of any kind of beating. Dr. Dupree also determined that Stephen's body was not staged. Due to the amount of blood at the scene and on the body, it's believed that he was hit with a single blow by something fast and large. In May 2023, Alex was indicted on federal fraud charges, and in September, he pleaded guilty to all of them. Mm. On July 16th, 2023, the family of Mallory Beach reached a $15 million deal to settle a lawsuit against the convenience store that sold Paul the alcohol while he was underage. The full settlement was for $18 million, with three of those millions being split amongst the remaining passengers. In August, Corey Fleming, Alex's attorney who helped steal the insurance money from Gloria's sons, he pled guilty to 23 charges, including fraud and money laundering. He was sentenced to almost 14 years in prison, and he was also disbarred. So this is just like, nobody's doing good.
Taking them all out.
On September 5th, 2023, Alex's attorneys filed a motion for a new trial, alleging jury tampering by Colleton County Clerk of Court. Oh my God. Colleton County Clerk of Court, Rebecca Hill. The defense attorneys alleged that Becky Hill told the jury not to believe Murdaugh's testimony and other evidence pressured a swift guilty verdict. In November, Alex pleaded guilty to 22 of his 101 state financial charges. He was sentenced to 27 years in prison for this and other financial crimes related to embezzling insurance payouts from his clients. In January last year, Murdaugh's motion for a new trial was denied, and in March, the county clerk of court, Rebecca Hill, resigned. Murdaugh's attorneys appealed to the state Supreme Court, and in August, the court agreed to review the lower court's decision. So as of right now, the state Supreme Court is going to look into whether or not he should get a retrial, because whether or not the clerk of the court tampered with the jury.
Hmm.
But either way, he's like already going to be in jail for a long time because of all the financial crimes he's committed. Currently, he is in protective custody at a maximum security state prison, and he only interacts with people who live and work in his unit. He spends his time playing chess and working as a ward keeper's assistant. And then something I found a little annoying is in Maggie's obituary, it says she is survived by her loving husband, Richard Alexander Murdaugh. And I'm just like, you know, he's convicted of killing her. Maggie's father's health has been declining since the murders, which I found was sad. And Buster Murdaugh still believes his father is innocent. So what do you guys think? Do you think that Alex was a convenient scapegoat? Or... No. Were there two short shooters? Because some people believe that Buster was on scene.
Two short little shooters.
I thought that originally about, like, Buster, like, doing it as well, but, like...
I don't know. I think it was Alex.
And where do you guys think the guns went?
He's got how many acres? Like, who's to say he didn't dig a spot up and hide it?
Mm-hmm.
Drive him away somewhere. A lot of land to hide stuff.
It seems that
dump him in the water.
Yeah. Based on the phone activity, it seems that Maggie and Paul were murdered at 8:49, and he didn't call the police until 10:07.
And you know what else? Not to try to throw blame on anybody else, but I'll do it because it's the podcast. You said that when the police were there, his brother was allowed access to him, right? His brother, the lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
He could have even stashed the gun somewhere just temporarily, and then when his brother got there, have him take him off somewhere.
Yeah.
It seems like a family that covers for each other's shit, so.
I'm not going to say anything about that because he is not disbarred. He is still a lawyer.
Oh.
Randy is. And
well, that's just my stupid little idea.
I feel like the motive doesn't make sense for him to gain sympathy. Like, if they're, like, thinking that the motive was, like, what? Like, for sympathy of, like...
Yeah.
Other things.
His wife and son died.
Feel like they were probably in the midst of a divorce or getting divorced, and that pissed him off. So he wanted to, like... It was kind of like, well, you're not allowed to leave me. And then he also probably saw not Alex. What's the son's name again?
Paul.
He probably saw Paul as like a fuck up and was like, well, he's not gonna, he's causing so much trouble.
So the whole, like, I like the idea that Paul's fuck up where he crashed the boat was causing a lot of stress for Alex, especially because there are all these lawsuits coming, and Alex was saying that he's broke and couldn't afford to pay millions of dollars in settlements, and the lawyers were like, well, show us your bank accounts. And he was worried that this was going to reveal the fact that he's been committing embezzlement and tax evasion and all that shit for years.
And he could have been banking on the idea that people aren't going to want to sue a man who just lost his wife.
Yeah, so maybe that's what they meant by sympathy.
Yeah. You know, oh, we don't want to bother him with this right now. He's going through something horrific.
So with that, I was like, okay, so, like, do you think that he intended on killing both of them? Or did he intend on just killing Maggie and Paul got involved? Or did he intend on killing Paul because Paul brought all this trouble with the boat and Maggie got involved? But, like, I don't know.
But I feel like if he wanted to just do one of them,
just bring it one could have been with or, you.
Like, easy just to lure one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like, he knew they were both on the property.
Yeah, like, you didn't have to, like,
and then the fact that he seems to be prepared with two guns.
I also feel like that was pre-thought of. I mean, he had, what, like 10 or 15 guns to choose from? He probably thought, like, oh, if I use at least two, that'll derail the investigation to the point of, like, there has to be two shooters. Well, one person would use two guns.
Exactly. I mean, he is also a lawyer, so he might know that was an argument. I didn't mention it, but after the shootings, while speaking to Maggie's sister, she was like, she had, like, expressed that she was nervous because the killer was still at large, and she noticed that Alex didn't seem concerned. And that he had mentioned, like, it seemed like something someone had been planning for a while. And she thought that that was strange.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I really liked the documentary. I don't know if you watched it, Drew, when you were doing this or not, but if you didn't, you guys should both watch it. I think you'd like it. They really focused heavily first on, like, the boat crashing incident.
Yeah.
And then kind of built from there, but that's why. So I came in, when you said it was this case, I was like, oh, I already have made up my mind fully about Alex Murdaugh.
Oh, yeah? What's your mind?
That he did it.
Okay, I think everybody's jury has also made up their mind.
Yeah.
I think that the one thing that the juror said where it was like, if he didn't do it, how did you know what time to lie about not being there?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. But they're like, some people are like, he and Buster did it together and he's covering for them both, like, he's covering for Buster, which it, what I mean, if Buster did it,
what would be Buster's motive?
That's what I was gonna say. I feel like his motive is already, like, Alex's motive is already kind of, like, weak whichever way we spin it. It cannot be easy to talk your kid into killing their mom. You know, when they don't have a good motive for it. And Buster was the kid. Buster, like, Paul was the fuck up. Buster was the one who was doing everything he was supposed to be.
Like, take it easy.
Okay, I don't love him either, though.
He was drunk driving a boat and killed a girl. Okay, so it doesn't matter if he's dead. He's a fuck up.
It's sad that he's dead. He was a fuck up.
And he sounded an asshole to be, like, arguing with his girlfriend and slapping her around, too. So
I think it would be hard for him to have talked Buster into participating.
Yeah. And if it was, like, if it wasn't, like, a talk into, it was just, like, a, hey, let's kill Mom and Paul. What's Buster's motive?
Right.
I don't know. I don't know. I feel like I feel as though Alex is involved because of all of the phone evidence. Like, why were all his calls mysteriously missing from his phone?
He just was spring cleaning and wanted to delete some. He needed more storage space.
Deleted phone calls?
Yeah.
The fact that he lied, and then what the juror said, if he wasn't there, how do you know what time to lie? But the motive is a little... But again, he was high, so maybe he wasn't in his right mind, and he wasn't thinking.
Yeah. This if he might had not been work. Using drugs, you know, maybe it made clear sense to him.
I feel like if Buster was involved, now that you bring up the phones, we would have seen, like, we would have found, like, Buster's, like, phone there.
The GPS.
Because it would be weird for just one of them to know not to touch your phone or not to bring your phone to the crime scene or act strange with it. Like, because if he was involved, he would probably tell his dad, like, hey, don't do anything weird with your phone.
Yeah. But, I mean, Alex's phone was left in the hunting lodge for an hour, not moving.
No, like, weird, like, don't delete shit after we did this.
That looks pretty suspicious, Dad.
A little bit.
Yeah. But, like, the other thing that bothers me is the whole shooting of Maggie. Like, I don't understand why you would shoot her close by, twice in the front. And then once she's on her hands and knees, circle around to the back of her and shoot her again. And then circle around to the front of her and shoot her again. Why are you walking around that much?
What if he was, maybe shot her in the front and then he was, like, worked up and he's kind of pacing and he's like, ah. And as he paces behind her, he shoots her a couple more. I don't know. I don't love that.
Maybe she surprised him like the other one did. Like, when she was, like, walking towards him. He fired them twice, then didn't want to look her in the face to shoot her, so went behind her.
I can get on board for the first circle around to the back, but then why would he come around to the front again? Also, I just, real quick, the prosecution also noted during trial that he said during the 911 call that he checked pulses and stuff, and he tried to turn Paul's body, but again, like, because the defense was like, there's no blood on him. But they were like, did you see the pictures of Paul? If he had been touching Paul, you would think that there'd be blood.
He washed his hands.
Yeah, because, you know, the hose is missing. Anything else?
No.
All right, well, that was sinister.
And we tried to be sarcastic, but that was kind of
dark. We were sarcastic.
I mean, there was a lot of information. I feel like a lot of it was fucked up and it was hard to interject, but
we hope you keep listening.